Welcome to Debug. We're doing a special roundtable tonight focusing on iOS 7 development. Guy English is not yet here. We are hoping he will join us in midstream, but we do have Marco Armont, formerly of Instapaper and the magazine, now of the Accidental Tech Podcast, Marco.org, and the upcoming podcast client, Overcast. How are you, Marco?
Great, thanks.
We also have Sean Heber of the Icon Factory and Twitterific. How's it going, Sean?
Good.
We have Brent Simmons of NetNewsWire fame, now working on Vesper. How are you, Brent?
I'm good.
And we have Matt Drance, former evangelist at Apple and now the Apple Outsider. How are you, Matt?
Great, guys.
So we've been dancing around iOS 7 on this show for a long time because unlike the design stuff we talked about on Iterate, Apple showed off everything about how it looked and how it interacted, but they had everything about how it actually worked inside under NDA. The NDA is now dropped. So maybe we could just start with you, Brent, because, you know, you've got the new version of Vesper out and on the App Store. What was it like working with iOS 7?
Well, it was surprisingly a lot like working with iOS 6, except for some changes, some of which were wonderful, some of which were really a pain. The wonderful stuff, at least for me, is TextKit. And Vesper has a detail view. It's a note-taking app. So it shows a note, and a note, of course, is a bunch of text. And we do a little text formatting there. And in iOS 6, it was barely possible to do what we did. And in fact, it didn't always work correctly. But we shipped anyway, because it mostly worked. But then TextKit came along, and it's like, wow, we can totally do what we want to do and do even more things in the future if we want to. And it's simple and works the way you would hope it would work. And so we were all, especially me, extremely pleased to see that added. Of course, in a way, it seems like iOS 7 is just now catching up to the 1984 Mac in terms of some things, right? Text formatting being one of them. But that was a really huge, big deal for me. As far as stuff I didn't like that much, the change with the status bar meant I had to just screw with a whole bunch of different code I never expected to have to touch. Dealing with that was a little bit of a pain, but, you know, that's okay. And then, of course, there are the bugs. There's always bugs.
Did anyone else play around with TextKit at all? I mean, it looked great when they showed it off at the keynote.
We wanted to. We haven't really adopted it yet because we had a lot of legacy Cortex stuff and it still worked, so we kept that and worked on other things, but I plan to eventually get rid of that and use TextKit. It's definitely one of the more interesting, like, it's going to make things a bazillion times easier, but since the old stuff worked, we just left it alone.
I like how Apple waited until Marco sold off every one of his TextBigs products before they introduced it.
Yeah, that was really nice. They also, like, 7 also added a couple of things, including TextKit, but also including UI WebView pagination and a few other things that, like, things that took me forever to get right manually with Instapaper. And
how the hell did you do pagination?
Yeah.
I've thought about that.
It's really tricky. Yeah. The I'll try to give you the short version. First algorithm, which you'll be shocked that this even worked, was I literally screenshotted the buffer that showed the image of the page and scanned for solid lines to declare when to break it. And then I just drew obscuring views to create the top and bottom margins at the nearest line, which is why the old method could actually cut a lowercase I in half, and you'd have a dot on the page above and then the rest of the page below. And that actually worked and was fast enough even on the iPhone 1. But the new method involved, I forget most of the details, but the new method from about 2 years ago changed to some new-ish HTML5 DOM methods where you could get the dimensions of elements on the page as they were rendered. And like, you get the bounding boxes, so I just figured out, like, all right, how many of these things can I stack and where can I draw the page boundaries? Wow. But it was all a hack. And it always involved things like, you know, having views that obstructed the top and bottom margins to create the illusion of a page, and then putting that in with the UI page view controller to do the big iBook-style animations was a ridiculous pile of hacks, because you couldn't just say paginate this web view. You had to, like, I had to, like, take screenshots of it and stick it on a placeholder view controller during the transition, and it was a mess.
Well, it's double funny because now you also have the proper web script object in iOS 7. which would have made your hacks a little easier as well in terms of communicating that stuff back down.
What does that mean, the proper web script object?
Well,
proper before?
Well, I don't know, Marco, you could talk about this or I could talk about it. And, you know, there wasn't really a true, you know, if you're used to working on the Mac, you have this web script object or in the JavaScript core and all this other stuff that allows you to more directly translate things between JavaScript and Objective-C. We didn't have that on iOS until iOS 7. And before, what we would have to do is we would have to throw a JavaScript string. If we were talking from Objective-C, we'd have to throw a JavaScript string over the fence and say, do this, in order to send a message to JavaScript. And even worse, if we wanted to send a message from JavaScript back over, or we wanted to communicate something, like Marco just said, if you had a DOM event and you had some information you needed to pass back to Objective-C, what you basically needed to do was change the document's location and then use the web view delegates method in terms of auditing, should I go to this URL? And ultimately what you would do is you would have the JavaScript have some bogus URL with either a custom, you know, path or a custom a protocol or whatever, and then your Objective-C code would sniff that out and say, no, don't actually navigate to this, but I will go ahead and parse the URL and treat it as some kind of message.
Wow.
Yeah, coming from, like, I've never done Mac programming, really. I've made a few little things, but nothing even with an interface, really. And so for me, like, in the iOS world, all this stuff is new to me in the way that I don't even know what the Mac has. So I didn't even know what we were missing. I just knew that, okay, well, here's how you do these crazy things. Like, it seems really stupid that the UI web view is this limited, but I guess I'll just have to do that because I guess there's no better way.
That's interesting. And coming from the Mac, I hadn't looked. I assumed that web script object was there on iOS. I hadn't
exactly. And so now in the fall of 2007, when I was still at Apple doing API review, you can imagine me saying, what do you mean there's no web script object? And, you know, it was a combination, you know, the short story is a combination of security and performance and not enough time to do all the things that we're trying to do. And so they finally got around to bringing it over, which is exciting.
It seemed for a while, I mean, as I was running Instapaper for most of my iOS career so far, every single release, the first thing I would do, like as soon as we get out of the keynote at WWDC or as soon as the event ended and we could go look at the SDK, the first thing I would do is go look at the API diffs and go all the way down to the bottom to see what was added in UI WebView. And for release after release after release, it was nothing. There was just nothing added. It's just this API that had like four methods on it. Like there's nothing you could do. And, oh man. I mean, so much of Instapaper's original code was just hacking around that. Like originally UI WebView was not even a scroll view. And so, and like it kind of had this UI scroller thing inside of it, but that was private. You weren't really supposed to know about it or deal with it.
Right.
So for a while, it was actually fairly challenging to programmatically scroll it or to know when it had been scrolled. You had to use JavaScript. You had to like to programmatically scroll Instapaper the first time. I had to call JavaScript, you know, window.scrollTo, you know, whatever that call is, call that from Objective-C, and it was crazy.
The good old days.
Yeah. Oh my God. Now you could write Instapaper in a weekend, so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's always the weird balance. Like, for a while, when things are hard to do in the API, it's a competitive advantage if you do them, because it's really cool, because no one else is doing them, and you can say, wow, like, you know, the very first person who replicated the iBooks page turning animation, like, wow, that's really cool. And then in iOS 5, they go and add it as the class anybody can use. And it's like, well, I guess it was really cool that I did it, but now anybody can do it. And, you know, same thing with collection views. So many people wrote their own collection views.
Sure. Yeah.
Myself included, yep. probably you guys too. I mean, yep. There's, you know, there are so many of these things where it's really cool that no one else can do it. So we pour hours and hours and hours into doing it manually. And it's great for us until everyone else can do it. And then it's like, well, I like deleting code, but now it's no longer special. It's this weird trade-off.
Yep.
Well, you have to find the next hard thing to do. That's
exactly. Progress. Yeah.
And Marco, they also got rid of, well, they also added in all the new refreshing, content refreshing stuff, thereby making all your geofence code no longer necessary either.
Oh, thank God. I was every time I would talk to somebody from Apple, I would say, please let me delete this stupid feature. There's no reason this feature needs to exist. It's right. It's such a terrible hack workaround. We're all trying all these random, you know, people tried like weird background audio tricks. People tried like, you know, certain, like, I mean, Newsstand had its content available push. No one else did. Like, people had so many weird hacks to get around this limitation that it was just like, come on. Like, how many people in the last year had geofencing running on their phones solely for an app that used it to fake background refresh?
Yeah.
Like, really. So, you know, they had to add it eventually because we were all doing these terrible hacks around it. So yep. It's one of those things, again, I'm very glad to have that. And if I were still owning Instapaper, I could not wait to delete that feature.
So who's using that? Who's using NSURL session right now for at least backgrounding purposes?
I will be, but I haven't started yet.
Yeah.
I'm using it in development, but my app's not out yet, so it's running on one right. of them right now.
And are you, Marco, are you 7 only? We can branch into that.
Of course. Oh, my God. Yes.
Well, yeah, it's a new app, so sure.
What's different this time, I mean, what's severely different, which is awesome, is first of all, iOS 7, because 6 auto updates, iOS 7 has obviously, as we know, had really, really fast adoption. But mm-hmm. also, the critical change that makes it easy to go 7 only is that Apple now allows people to download older versions if the newer versions won't run on their device.
Right.
And that changes everything, because before, and also now that people don't usually sync with iTunes, so... Before, if you would sync to iTunes and iTunes would download a new version of an app that couldn't run on your phone, next time you synced, it would delete the old one off your phone. So that was very destructive, and I got a lot of angry emails about that, and as everyone did, I'm sure. And then, so now, not only do most people not sync to iTunes, which dodges that one, but now, if you have an iOS 6 only device, then you try to download an app, and it says, sorry, you know, the new version requires iOS 7, but you can download the last compatible version. And so now there's a lot less reason for anybody to hang on and support old OSs forever.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how far back that goes? Because I booted up my original iPhone and tried to download things, and it was I think it's on 3.1.3, and it just told me nothing was available.
I don't know. I'm surprised it even goes back to. Does it go back to 5? Do we know?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, that's the original iPad. That's the big question.
Yeah, because losing the iPad 1 with 6 kind of hurt.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
You can also not allow it, right? So if you have an app that depends on APIs that no longer exist or fundamental things have changed that just break your app, you can opt out of that feature, I believe.
Correct.
Yeah, you can. But you go in like, it's same thing with like the legal issue thing that they introduced a couple of years ago. You can go in and say, all right, these versions don't make available for download.
Sean, yeah, what's interesting about that checkbox, sorry, Renee, when that checkbox showed up in iTunes Connect, everybody assumed that it had something to do with LODSIS or patent trolls or something like that, because it was around the same time, and people thought that maybe Apple was trying to keep tabs on how badly the patent troll situation was affecting their business and things like that. And that may be true. We have no idea why that showed up. But knowing now that it's linked to this behavior that we're now seeing in the store, and maybe that was the motivation all along, is for the store to decide whether or not it should save the old version or make it available or something like that. So that was also sort of a really interesting retrospective thing.
Does it seem to you that iTunes Connect is actually that planned out?
When it's a legal issue, yes. You know, like, yeah. Yeah, so, but anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Renee.
No, I was just going to ask Sean because, and I know it's a complete first nerd problem, but one of the things with Twitter apps before is you'd get the push notification. You'd tap on that, you'd go to the Twitter app, then have to wait for it to refresh. And it would take so long sometimes because of network issues. You know, you'd pull down Notification Center and try to read as much of your tweet as possible. And now it seems like you have all the apparatus you need to get those messages into Twitterific as fast as they could be into Notification Center, for example.
Oh, yeah. We used... We do the background fetch thing. I don't think we're doing the NSURL session thing, but the thing where it wakes you up like after an hour or something like that. And so the app wakes up and it just does a normal refresh. And it's really cool because it seems the advertised feature of them like predicting when a person uses your app appears to work really well. It's remarkable how many times I switch into Twitterific at my
times of day where I'm, you know, always checking, and it's like it's already updated it. You know, we didn't even do anything special aside from support that background fetch. We haven't looked at, I know you can send special push notifications now that like wake up the app and force it to do something. And we haven't done that yet, although that's something we might do, you know, to come along with your push of a mention or something so that it actually gets downloaded before you switch to it. But for the most part, the automatic algorithm works remarkably well there. And yeah, it's really nice. It's alleviated the need to support streaming a lot, I think. Of course, users still want streaming, but
it's this idea of just-in-time backgrounding, because I've used devices that just are full-on background and you can watch your battery drain away. But as a user, it's the perception of background that I need. I just need it to be refreshed a few seconds before I get there, and then it might as well have always been refreshed. I can't tell the difference.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it feels a lot of the time. You know, it's not perfect because they place a limit on how often it's going to wake up your app and things like that. And it's kind of out of your control, but it works well enough that for the most part, it's, you know, it's magical. And that's like one of those nice things that Apple occasionally gets just right, you know, where it's a feature that it would be pretty hard, I think, to write the code to do that. And they did it for everyone. That kind of prediction of when to wake your app up.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
It sounds smart too, because it'll do coalescing. So if the GPS fires up, any other app that needs it will go along with it. If you turn on the screen, anything else that needs power from the CPU will just go along. I mean, Matt, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it yet, but it seems like an incredibly smart way. And I wouldn't be surprised to see more multitasking go that direction in the future.
Yeah, to me, it seems like a no-brainer. You know, I think one of the things in terms of adopting one bit or the other, and you know, Sean hinted at it when he talked about TextKit, is, you know, we're only 3 months in here. And, you know, a lot of us, as Brent already said, a lot of us were busy just making things work because there was a great deal of change, which is separate from breakage, the new UI, the new system, the new rules, definitely put a lot of stress on a lot of us. And I can say that with confidence as somebody who's lived on both sides of the fence when it comes to these migrations. A lot of this stuff, I think iOS 7 is going to have a lot of legs in terms of people upgrade to the system, they update all their apps, and they're probably, you know, just really high strung is the wrong term, but, you know, they're very attentive right now as far as what's going to change. And there's going to be a lot more change to come in the next 3, 6, 9 months as developers finally catch up with everything that's been made available. And yeah, the background stuff, the multitasking improvements are just one of them.
There's a remarkable amount of code that we were able to delete by going iOS 7 only.
Yeah.
And, you know, and like I said, we didn't even get the TextKit, you know. I mean, that's a whole nother huge chunk of code.
Yep.
Yep.
So it's pretty amazing that we're like adding magic by removing code.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so
what
else could you delete?
There was a lot of, I can't think of it now. There was an awful lot of stuff is related, at least in our case, because, you know, we were like a heavily design centric kind of an app, you know. Mm-hmm. So even though we had the kind of flat look before Apple released it, there was still a lot of support code to make that work right, I guess, as of iOS 6. But with 7, the way the UI looks, you know, the style, and then the defaults of the new controls were such that, I mean, we had just countless, you know, custom UI buttons or whatever that did like silly things like move the label over by X amount, you know, in certain circumstances or whatever. And like all of that's gone now. You know, we had all this crazy stuff to support certain kinds of gradients behind things. And because we don't need the gradients anymore, we could just get rid of that. And then as we were pulling pieces out, you know, we eventually realized that almost everywhere we can use like UI button, you know, like it isn't even a subclass anymore. You know, it's like,
yeah,
things like that are crazy. And we still have a lot more to do on that front. But UIView controller containment and stuff like that works so much better when you don't have to worry about inserting like UI elements around it, or like, you know, forcing like some kind of Chrome around the edge or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah. And I was, you just mentioned the button stuff. You know, I think one of the big understated things, you know, this might not necessarily translate directly to a user experience, but you know, the just the universal tint support that you see now in iOS 7, and we had gotten sort of tastes of this as of iOS 5 with UI appearance, but in iOS 7 they really just opened the door and everything sort of is tintable, for, you know, is what, you know, tint is the word they use, but it's really almost a mask. And you know, I told my designer the other day that, you know, he supplies me images and I haven't yet profiled or examined the performance implications of this, but you know, the old method of, at least while you're iterating during development, of saying, well, this color's a little off, I need to burn you a new asset. Well, not anymore. You know, the designer, you know, if you've got a button with a border or a background or whatever, and you decide you don't like that color, you actually could just suddenly use that border effectively as a mask and change the tint on the button, and you can iterate that way until you find what you like. And then if you want, then you can have the designer reburn the image. But I haven't gone crazy with the tint support, but I've done enough investigation to know that sort of possibility exists.
Oh yeah, the tint stuff reminds me. That was one of the big things. That's why we had custom images and buttons all over the place, was we were doing a lot of that, you know, but we had custom controls, so that way our designer could give us a button, we could tint it. And now it took a week or something, but then I realized that all you have to do is use the image as the always template mode, whatever that is, on a UI image view, and you can just be like tint color. And you know, it used to be you would do draw rect and you would like blend it, and it's like all of that's gone, you know, so much faster too.
Yeah. I mean, so is that, you know, I mentioned performance before, and it's something that I played around with a little bit, but I didn't really get around to building a workflow around it. Have you noticed it being any kind of problem performance wise?
I haven't measured it, but anything that results in you never using draw rect is like better.
Yeah. So, well, I guess if you were already drawing and blending yourself, then it probably is a win anyway.
Yeah, because, you know, there were a number of cases where we got rid of, you know, custom draw recs. And then if you really look down into it, you know, you realize that the button was like, you know, 100 by 50 or something, you know, and that it didn't need to be that big, but it was only that big for tap area reasons, you know. And so, of course, underlying it, it's generating a bitmap that's like, you know, yay big and taking up space and wasting all this time just so you can do a color blend. You know, and now you can just do a tint color on the image view.
Yep. And if you're so bold, that's the sort of thing where if you have the kind of app where you want to support something like theme support or whatever, you know, give the user some kind of power to customize things to a certain degree, that's where that becomes really, really powerful. Because before it would be like you'd have red or blue and you'd have to supply a whole set of images for that. And now you could potentially just give the user a color wheel. Not that I'm advocating it, but I'm just talking about the power that's been introduced very silently, I would add. You know, this is the sort of thing that users don't understand until somebody does something interesting with it. But that exists right now in iOS 7, and I haven't seen anybody really sort of take that to any sort of interesting conclusion.
Well, we're kind of doing that in our app, not to give our users the opportunity, but so that my designers can sit there and tweak. We have a bunch of these parameters in a plist, and they just put in hex values and they could change the colors of all the buttons and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And that way they can iterate quickly and do actual builds on their devices and leave me out of it, which is really cool.
Yeah. We do that with Twitterific too. We have, a light and a dark theme, and actually we used to use UI appearance to do that, which was really bad. Like I would just run all the UI appearance setters every time they switched the theme, and it turned out that was really bad. But it worked. But we yanked all of that for iOS 7, like all of it, just in the, you know, because UI appearance technically is swizzling and stuff in the background, you know, that's how it works. And it's nice feeling knowing that it's not even swizzling, even if it was Apple doing it.
What's yeah, nice I had no idea about, it was swizzling in the background.
That's crazy. Well, UI appearance has always been very limited because it doesn't live update. Like if you change something, it doesn't automatically change every instance of that thing.
It was very slow.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't dig into like all of the internals. I know it swizzled internally because like sometimes it would crash there and you would see the method calls. And but it was very, very slow. Like now on Twitter, if you switch between light and dark, it's like instantaneous as of iOS 7, largely because of tint color and just how much better that is and how much more sense it makes, I guess. I mean, wow. I admit we were pretty much abusing UI appearance. I think the idea behind that was you set it once and never change it. But
yeah, but that's a great data point from what I was asking before. I mean, if you're telling me it's faster than UI appearance, then...
Oh, yeah, it very much is. Because UI appearance, the only way that we found to get it to even reapply the rules for UI appearance was you had to remove all the views and put them back. So like the hack was we would do all the setters for UI appearance to like change it to the dark theme or something, right? And then remove the root view controller and then re-add it to the window. And then that would cause everything to get recreated. So you can imagine how slow that is.
Yep.
With the tint color stuff, it's like you change it and it just goes down the existing views and you're done. You know, it's way faster.
What's awesome too about the new iOS 7 style is, you know, and this helps out Brent with Vesper a lot too, is that the style now is so much less graphical in nature. There's so many fewer textures and everything. It's so much more about line art and vectors and shapes that, and just use of text and color and white space, that it's a lot easier to make everything procedural. Like, you know, like letterpress, famously, Lauren Brichter's letterpress. As far as I know, the only images in the entire bundle are the launch images and the icon. There's no images in that entire game. It's all procedurally generated. And as a programmer, I love that because that's something that I can do. You know, like they moved it into a style that's easier for me to do. And then it's so much easier when you're iterating over things, you know, like what Brent said and like, you know, like Sean, what you said with the Icon Factory with Twitterific, how you know, you can iterate over all these different designs without having to like manually deal with these textures and swapping them in and out and everything and, these very fragile, like baked in interfaces. Now everything can be much more dynamic, much more procedural, and it's just so much easier to deal with.
Yeah. In our case, Twitterific 4, I think it was heavy, heavy on the images. You know, every little thing was a custom little image, you know. Right. 5, we did almost totally procedural. And then when iOS 7 came along, that was a huge benefit because we didn't have to redo as much. I mean, I think all of Twitterific, even with 64-bit, is only like 6 megs or something like that.
Wow.
And that's with the icon and everything.
And just think too, you know, in the old style of design, let's say you made your entire interface out of this one shade of red that what you decided was like your theme color of red for the interface. And then what if you wanted to, you know, play with that a little bit? Like, oh, you know what? Let me try that a little bit lighter. When it's all baked into images, you just can't. Like, that's like hours of work to regenerate all those images. When it's procedural, you can change one variable and, oh, let's test it. Look, here it is.
Yeah. And it's fast enough that you can literally have like a debug slider and change the color live, you know?
And you could, and if you wanted to put that in a configuration file, kind of like Brent has, and that's something you could even control remotely if you needed to.
Oh, yeah.
Which is where we get into the gray area of, you know, what's acceptable and what's not. But I mean, potentially with this sort of stuff, you can just have a plist on Amazon S3. You know, it doesn't even need to be something fancy that the app just goes and phones home every once in a while. And you say, you know what? I screwed up the tint color on this screen. Well, we're going to update the plist remotely and not even submit anything to the App Store, and people are going to get that color tint bug fix.
Make a marker felt backdoor.
You know, I actually shipped software allows based on that years ago.
The modern, just like in movies, you know, when hackers can like completely redefine the software, it's now possible.
Yeah.
Brent, you guys had to deal with Apple kind of took over the idea of the basement and the hamburger button. And I know Facebook with their double-ended hamburgers and basements were doubly screwed, but you guys always had a nice mechanic for that, and it seems to translate to iOS 7 fairly well.
Yeah, it seems to work. The main change we had to make was just using the screen edge pan gesture instead of just panning anywhere. And we're getting some complaints about that, that, you know, the screen edge is a little too fussy or something like that. But otherwise, it's yeah, it's working out nicely. We had added some parallax to it, to the, we call the sidebar, back even back in iOS 6, because you know, we have dynamics and motion effects now, but some of these things are actually pretty trivial to implement even in the old fashioned way. A little bit of parallax here and there is not that hard necessarily. But yeah, it's, you know, that design didn't have to change much for iOS 7. It was just a matter of the background that we wanted to change. And what we wanted was to have the user's wallpaper show through. And apparently that's not allowed. And I'm not sure why.
Interesting.
Not allowed, or they just didn't have time to make it allowed?
I don't know.
They probably, I mean, there are a bunch we could talk about this. There are a couple of things that have been closed off, presumably due to performance battery concerns. And that's one of, you know, we know that some of the Apple apps have the wallpaper showing through them. You know, people have done the experiments. And then similarly, the, you know, the glass effect that you see in the notification center and the nav bars and stuff, that's not something that you can just do right now.
Right.
There are sneaky ways of doing it that a lot of people are taking advantage of, but I would put it on that shelf that they're just not ready to make it available to people. And it's probably a combination of wanting to control the aesthetic as well as being concerned about the performance and battery implications.
Sure. But if Safari is doing this, you know, all day long, you know, and Passbook and others too.
Yeah, like, sure, sure.
You know,
sure.
And as far as controlling the aesthetic, you know, have you been to the App Store? I mean, there's no, you know.
Well, right. That's yeah. That's the persistent counter argument. Yeah. I'm not, I'm trying to explain rather than defend.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Right. And to anyone at Apple listening, please open that up. It's one of those, it's like a defining characteristic of iOS 7 is that it's a layered UI. You can sometimes see what's behind. Apple apps get to do this thing that now users expect. And we can't. And, you know, that just bugs me. Well, it especially bugs my designers who, you know, are really inconsolable over this.
Lauren said as a graphical engineer, it made the amount of blur shading hitting the GPU made him cry.
We don't even want blur. We just want to slightly darken the wallpaper. That's it. We don't even want blur.
Well, and they don't even have right now a method to detect the device color. Like there, and there, that information is available through a private call on UI device, but you obviously can't get that through approval. So, like, that's another thing. Like, that would be really cool. Apple's doing this thing where they're like, they're color matching the wallpaper, at least the default wallpaper, to the case color of the iPhone 5C. And the color of the 5C and even the color of the 5S, the metal color, that's all available in the software. Just not, we aren't allowed to use it. And that's another thing. Like, an app could do a cool, like, little visual customization with that, to just have like a nice little touch, and we aren't allowed to do that.
That is cool. I didn't know they were doing that.
Well, we can't. but no, I didn't know.
I don't have every color of iPhone, so I
for testing you have to get them all.
They're afraid of too many gold themes hitting the App Store.
Yeah, I am rich.
Well, gold in an app purchase.
Is there anything else anybody wanted to do that they weren't able to do yet just because it was a private API or it wasn't surfaced?
That transparency thing for me was the big one. Yeah.
So what else did you end up doing when you transitioned Vesper to iOS 7? Because like Twitterific, it was already a very forward-thinking app, and now you were just sort of landing it in the same place Apple landed.
Well, my designers seem to go around and around about a whole bunch of different things, and I'll be damned if I can remember what they all were at this point.
The status bar was a big one. I mean, I think Whiskers was blogging about that for months.
Yeah, that was a pain. One thing we decided quickly was that we would actually have a colored nav bar rather than the standard white that Apple was going with. And I think it was an easy decision for us, but it could have been difficult, or it could have been difficult not to go white, just because it seemed like iOS 7 wants all nav bars to be white. But we went with the color there. Jeez, what else?
And that's the only way you can blur still, right? Is to use...
Yeah. Right. And so we're not doing any blurring. It's just a solid color up at the top.
But you got to figure some people are stretching blur nav bars over the entire screen at this point.
Oh, yeah. That's the most common way to do it is you just pull, you just either add a toolbar or nav bar of the right dimensions as a subview, or you pull the layer off of a toolbar and stick that as a sublayer of yours. Yeah, there's a few ways to do it. It's all the same concept, though.
Exactly.
Yeah, I learned that you can treat a UI toolbar just like any other view and just add stuff to it. Yeah, just impute it.
So my question for Brent, having discussed the status bar, which of course was a thorn in my side as well, is how long did it take you to find top layout guide and bottom layout guide on UI View Controller?
You know, I still don't know what those do.
Well, there you're welcome. Yeah, so,
thank
well,
you.
You're welcome, and I'm sorry because I didn't find them until 80 hours into it.
Well, aren't those only for auto layout?
Yes, they are.
And I'm using auto layout, so yeah.
Yeah, but you know, and this is nobody's fault. It's just it just goes to show there's so much that came through in iOS 7 that you know, even the WWDC videos, some of those WWDC videos are so thick that you know you cannot check your email or go refill your glass of water or whatever. You know, you have to. You have to pay attention to every single slide in there because blink and you will miss something. I actually don't know if the layout guides were mentioned in iOS 7 at WWDC, but it's a pretty big deal in terms, you know,
they were very briefly.
All right. Yeah. I did a lot of manual, you know, bounds adjustments when I didn't have to if I had seen that API.
I remembered seeing it and I found it too, but I don't know. There's some serious problems with it too. I don't think it works all the time.
Oh, really? Okay.
I know.
I feel less bad then.
I have one radar open where it's like a tab bar controller and a table view in one tab and a table view in the other tab. And like the first one will be right and the second one is all wrong. Like it doesn't adjust correctly. And it's as simple as that and it's still broken. I don't know. It's been broken since like beta 4 or 5.
And these are table views in two different tabs.
Right. It's like you set up a table view and you put a table or a tab controller and then put a table in each tab. Yeah, it'll be right in the first one. And then when you switch over, you can tell that the guidelines are there or the cell lines are wrong. You know, it's wrong. It's off. And we have a couple problems like that in Twitterific still that. It appears the magic has gone awry.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure. We're kind of waiting on those and we'll just see. Hopefully like 7.1 fixes it. I don't know.
Do you like auto layout in general, Matt?
I do very much. And that's new. That's a very new development. You know, I say this when I do training, I say this to the students where, you know, when a new technology comes out, there are just these three stages of technology adoption. And so stage one is violent allergic reaction. And, I have finally left the violent allergic reaction phase of auto layout. The second stage is overdose where you say, oh, I understand this and I'm going to use it everywhere. Where, you know, just as with everything in life, you know, the answer is always somewhere in the middle. You know, it's never black and white. And then the third stage is Zen, which could take anywhere between weeks and years. So, I'm not going to say I understand auto layout yet, but, I've made peace with it and I'm starting to be productive and, it's really cool. I mean, the big problem is, you know, for people, you know, like me and Brent and, you know, I mean, you know, Mark, Sean, I don't know how long you've been in the business, but, you know, Marco, you've been around for five, six years. And, the real trick with auto layout is really to just stop thinking about the old way of doing things because there is no translation and there's really no analog. It's a new way of thinking about it. And, once you let all that go, there is a lot more power and a lot more capability. The new tools update really helped too in terms of Xcode, you know, making it easier to troubleshoot these things if you're working with Interface Builder. And Brent, I know you wrote about this shortly before WWDC.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that Interface Builder will allow you to create inconsistent auto layout thingies and not add a whole bunch of junk is a big step, I think.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten to a point where I can actually use, not that I would anymore now that everything's public, but I was actually able to go back to Xcode 4.3, the iOS 6 Xcode, and I was able to lucidly use auto layout with those old tools. So that's when I knew I had sort of crossed a boundary, so to speak. When even with the bad tools, so to speak, I was able to be productive. So I'm a fan of the technology now. There are still places where I'm not ready to use it just because of the legacy nature of certain things I'm doing, but the value of it is very clear to me now.
Well, in general, declarative interfaces are cool.
Totally.
And so I like that, but you know, it's just that every time I've played around with it, it's like, it's just killing me.
Yeah. You really just have to let go. You have to let go and take a day or two. And the other thing I would say is watch the 2013 WWDC video. I think it's actually called Taking Control of Auto Layout.
Okay.
And watch the first 20 minutes of that and there are a bunch of really instructive and excellent demos. Watch it and have Xcode open and do the demos with the presenter and keep rewinding it until you get it.
All right. Cool.
And you will. I think I had to do it twice, and that was the turning point for me. It's a really good presentation.
See, now cool. I feel like I'm in danger of being obsolete, because usually when it comes to adopting new technologies like this, usually me and Brent are pretty much the last people on Earth to adopt them. And the trick for me, the way I know that I've waited too long is if Brent beats me to it.
Yeah,
well, now I feel like the pressure's on.
Exactly.
You want to hear some bad news, Marco?
You guys are both listening.
Oh, am I already beaten?
I just switched Vesper over to Core Data last weekend.
You?
Yes, me.
What?
Yep. Wow. That leaves just you, man.
Me and like my three contributors on FC Model. We're fighting the good fight.
Yeah, that's it.
Wow. Why?
What changed, Brent?
Well, a few things changed. One change, super small change in UI table view delegate or whatever, estimated row height, which means I can load tables faster. If I'm using, and it's fetch results controller, I don't have to fault in everything just to calculate all of the row heights, mm-hmm. right? That was a big drawback with NS fetch results controller. Now I don't have to do that. So, you know, that was a big stumbling block for me. Another change was that I was adding support for multiple attachments so that a note could have more than one picture. And that meant, you know, yet another relationship lookup table in my data model and dealing with that. And you know, I just thought to myself, you know what? Core Data is really, really good at relationships. So I thought I'll spend the weekend trying to do a Core Data version of all this and then see what the performance is like. And to my surprise, performance is really, really good. And so I still have to test it with like, you know, crazy amounts of data. I haven't done that yet. I could still throw this all away. But assuming it passes that test, then I'll keep using it.
Yeah, I feel like it really is about what you're using it for. For Instapaper, I did SQLite directly. For the magazine, I did Core Data. And I was very happy with both of those decisions. The new app I'm doing with FC Model, because I want to try it out, but because the data size is more like Instapaper than the magazine. But it really, I think you're right about things like the relationships. Like if you're doing a whole bunch of like one to many or many to many relationships, doing that manually in SQL kind of sucks. It's a lot of, you know, just grunt work of doing that. And it's very error prone. There's a lot of like weird conditions if you don't do the transactions right, where you could have inconsistent data resulting if something stops in the middle. And Core Data takes care of all of that, I think, for you. And and so if you have something like that where you have a complex relationship map, then Core Data is more likely the right choice for you. Whereas if you have something like you know, I'm doing this podcast app. Well, it's podcasts and episodes, and there's mm-hmm. That's one relationship. It's very, very easy. It's very flat. So there's not a whole lot to do there. It's like I'm basically going to have like two giant tables. And one being especially giant. So for that, it you know, my theory, I guess time will tell. My current theory is that when you have these giant tables where performance might be an issue if you do something slightly wrong or slightly inefficiently, then maybe doing it manually is better. But who knows? Time will tell.
So if I was writing an RSS reader today, which I'm not, I would not use Core Data. Because it's a ton of data. You have a giant table of articles and you have to do things like mark a billion as read or unread all in one go. And yeah, that's just not right for Core Data.
I still remember that post that you wrote. I was actually going to bring that up if you didn't. And that's the thing with Core Data is that we all treat it as a database API, but really it's an object API. Mm-hmm. And, you need to think of it like that. And yeah, I think Marco really hit it. Well, both of you hit it on the head as far as if you've got complex relationships and there's a bunch of baggage and administrative work that you would need to do that Core Data is doing for you, then it really is, I think, very useful. But yeah, if you're just dealing with two collections of things and you have many of them and it's not actually that complicated, then yeah, maybe there's other possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're using Core Data right now, and I think that it is not great. and I think that's the problem. You know, our data just does not fit that model correctly. Because we have that exact problem that, like Brent was saying, we try to mark them as read and stuff like that. And of course, you're iterating through all of these things, changing a single property. And on SQL, that would be like a single statement.
So I hate to be the former Apple employee here, but is that something you've raised with them? I know that I just said that it's an object API, not a database API, but it seems like there are things that could be, for lack of a better word, inlined like that. Like, set this property on every object of this entity to this value. And it seems like that's something that Core Data could keep abstract while also optimizing on your behalf, using a predicate or something like that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I have talked to an evangelist who is no longer an evangelist about this. But who does work at Apple. And I don't know if we made a lot of progress. I don't know if it got on the radar of the Core Data team or not. But, you know, he was keen to find a way to make it work for RSS readers. But, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, think the issue was KVO. That was like, you know, how's...
Right.
And I don't remember why that was the issue, but that was the issue.
Well,
I fixed it in FC model.
Well,
it works.
I don't know if I can answer the question, but I can tell you that KVO is how a managed object context knows that it has unsafe changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it's observing all of its objects, all of its all of its live objects. So, doing say a raw SQL write, then you would have to diff, what's currently in memory. Or, whatever the implications of that are, NS fetch results controller, whatever it is, you need to alert all these other things that are currently in motion that, hey, all this stuff changed.
I mean, that's exactly what I do. Like I have in my FC model thing, I have, you can do your regular writes and KVO tracks them all. I feel like I might have accidentally implemented part of Core Data, possibly badly. But there's a command where you can just say, run this update query on this table. And after it runs, it automatically sends a message to all live instances of that table saying, you got to go reload yourself. And then it goes and fetches and it even calls a conflict resolving method. If you have an unsaved change, it's different from what's in the table. And then the object can decide how to do that. But, that's the obvious way to solve this problem. That's how I solved it. And it seems to work pretty well so far, because the reality is, like, you might think that it'd be really horrible on performance or memory, but not only are these kinds of queries pretty unusual, but if you don't have the entire table in memory, like you have some kind of way to page it in and deal with only a subset of it. So the reality is, you aren't usually talking about a lot of these objects in memory having to update themselves.
Has anyone looked to see if the Core Data sync has gotten any less painful, unpredictable, or otherwise untenable for developers?
Is anyone ever going to try that again?
I'm wondering.
I've never touched it.
I have no idea. Tom Harrington would be the guy to ask, I think. He's not here, but he's got to ask.
Well, Brent, you're looking. I mean, it's well known now that you're looking at sync for Vesper, and I'm guessing iCloud's not going to be your first choice.
No, it's not. Yeah, I watched the WWDC video, and it looked like they've made a lot of improvements. Certainly easier to manage from the point of view of the developer, but I'm still spooked by it. I think a lot of people are, with good reason. But there is another problem with iCloud syncing. You know, suppose I want to add some other cool feature that requires a cloud. You know, iCloud doesn't give you anything there.
Right. Like suppose you wanted to have like an, you know, email something into my Vesper.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Or, you know, we came up with some publishing or sharing or whatever it might be. You know, a cloud service would be great. Or just say we want to do a web app or Android app or whatever. iCloud is just no help in all of these scenarios. And it just would kind of hurt to cut them all away and say, we will never do X, Y, and Z. When, you know, X, Y, and Z, yeah, they might be cool.
What do you guys think, or if you try to play around with UI dynamics or the motion effects? I mean, you know, Mike Mattis, Lauren Brichter famously did a lot of that stuff themselves, but now it's an API available to everybody.
It's another case where like hard things are suddenly really, really easy or somewhat easy, which is cool for the health of the platform, but it means us developers got to work harder to do hard things.
I'm just waiting for the app where every single tiny thing on the screen will bounce around like a game of Pong.
I mocked something like that up back in probably iOS 5. I just did Box 2D and attached, you know, boxes for UIKit things, and it was pretty funny. Like attach them to the screen, and you could break them free, and if you could shake your iPad really hard, they would bounce around.
Man, I cannot wait for the entire world to get over Drance's stage 2 of UI dynamics.
Yeah, I saw you talking about that the other day. I mean, it happens every time. It's still happening with blocks. How old are blocks now? 3 years old?
Yeah, good point.
We're still trying to force blocks down every single avenue. Yeah, these honeymoon periods, they could last a week or they could last, you know, like I said, they could last years. So, yeah, similarly, it's a pretty cool technology though. I mean, nothing I'm working on really has an obvious use for it. So, and then just in the same vein, I don't want to be that guy who, just jams in it, you know, pushes it through for no reason.
Sean, no indication of Ollie becoming a free motion bird in Twitterific?
No comment.
Nice.
Just looking at my list of stuff here. Was there anything on that big slide? I mean, Craig Federighi, every year they put up this big slide of APIs for developers, and it has different size fonts for, I guess, an importance heat indicator for APIs. And was there anything that caught your attention? Direction APIs, custom video compositors, inter-app. They added inter-app communication, but only for audio.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. They basically just took this thing that was already going on called AudioBus and just kind of built it in.
I'm trying to figure out what happened there.
I mean, the community, like the audio production and effects communities, were already doing this. They had already agreed on this protocol and. It was, I forget how it worked before. I think it was just over local network sockets or something. And Apple basically just made it official because audio apps, basically, I think audio apps could always run in the background. Like any number of them could run in the background, fairly unlimited. So they would stay open and they would continue working. I think something like that. But so there was this little community of like audio processing tools and effects tools and generators that would all support this. So Apple not only made the API official and built it in themselves, but they also let GarageBand be an AudioBus, I believe, receiver, but not sender. So it's one way, one of those. I think it's that way. But it's very unusual for Apple to build in an API for this really, really narrow use for this one kind of app. And I am a little curious why they did it for this in particular. And I guess you said the whole thing about you say the same thing about all of Newsstand too.
Yeah, it's one fragment of something that everyone would like to be system-wide.
Right. Oh, trust me, you do not want the Newsstand APIs. Oh my God. So there aren't a whole lot of people who have written new stand apps. Like I wrote very quickly in a post earlier this week how everyone always wishes that their app could get approved for auto-renewing subscriptions. Trust me, you do not want that, because auto-renewing subscriptions are terrible in so many ways. Like there are so many practical and API and UI problems with them, and support problems. I mean, it's so many problems. And you know, newsstand people know this, but like whenever I would have a question about newsstand, there was basically one person I could ask, and that was Matthew Bischoff of formerly the New York Times, who wrote their app. Like I met with him a few times, talked to him about it. I would always send him questions. Nice guy, and really knows his stuff. Now he works for Tumblr, which is awesome. But that's like, he was like the only one I could ask questions to. Like, there's no information on newsstand anywhere because no one's using it. But the APIs for that are pretty rough. And in 7, I believe they didn't change at all. And even when Apple added the whole URL session system and the background updates, which basically is like newsstand version 1.2 made available to everybody, even that, Apple's recommendation to newsstand people was just keep using your API, don't use this new stuff. So I got to feel like maybe they don't care about it anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. They some technology that seem to push very hard at the beginning, and then they don't abandon them, but they kind of leave them to wither on future iOS vines.
Yeah, it seems like newsstand was one of those like typical like Steve Jobs temporary pet projects.
Any interest in iBeacons or any of the? It seems like Apple really does not care at all about NFC, and they can do anything that anyone would, you know, name off the top of their head as an NFC-like technology through Bluetooth Low Energy, and they're making that available to developers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Resounding silence for iBeacons.
Got no thoughts on this one.
Well, I mean, I wrote about this last year about, you know, just the NFC bogeyman and that, you know, Apple's not going to be pushed around by that sort of thing. You know, it's, you know, let's not talk about NFC. Let's talk about the problem that NFC purportedly solves and figure out if that's a problem that we want to solve, and we'll solve it however the hell we want. And so iBeacon is a perfect example of that. You know, one thing that might surprise me a little bit is that it's apparently a closed thing. You know, because there are plenty of examples where Apple has done something and released it as an open solution because Apple's determined that it's in their interest for everybody to use their spec instead of somebody else's. You know, I'm not trying to put anybody on the spot, but I was a little surprised to hear that iBeacon was going to, you know, and it's never too late. They could open it up later, but it's cool. You know, you see that MLB is going to be using it, and you know, there are a lot of startups that were built around this concept of BTLE, you know, awareness. And this is sort of the power that Apple wields when, you know, you have 400 million, forget percentage market share, you've got 400 million potential retail customers or whatever who can be identified and alerted and given coupons or whatever as soon as they walk in your door. And, you know, just endless other things. You could do this in museums, you could do it at national parks, or, you know, like, I think it's cool. I think the idea, you know, the promise that things like NFC, you know, give is, you know, there's a lot of potential there in terms of how that promise is kept is, you know, that's much less important to me.
It's interesting because they seem to think in feature sets and not just chipsets. And they've had this in since iPhone 4S, I think, which gives them a huge install base. And I mean, everyone's statistics for iOS 7 adoption, I think, were even faster than we imagined it would be. So you have a fairly unified platform to use all this stuff as well. You mentioned...
Yeah, I agree.
Sorry.
No, that's it.
You guys mentioned Xcode previously. What do you think of the new version of Xcode, Matt?
Me?
Yep.
I think it's great. You know, it's an you know, there's nothing revolutionary in there. It's an incremental upgrade. I think Xcode 5 is demonstrably better than the last Xcode, in all the right ways. There's a lot of stuff. You know, you asked before, things that we haven't maybe been able to take advantage of yet. And I was thinking strictly in terms of APIs, but there's a lot of stuff in Xcode itself that I've not yet touched. You know, the unit testing support appears to be way better, and there's continuous integration stuff built into Xcode now, and Mavericks, now that, you know, Mavericks is allegedly gone GM. You know, so there's a lot of stuff in there that I'm looking forward to taking advantage of. You know, if people are doing cross-platform work, then they've probably got something built around Jenkins already, and they may not want to walk away from that. But if you're doing Mac or iOS only, then the stuff that's been built into Xcode and Mavericks could be really, really compelling. So I like the new update, and going back to an earlier topic as well, the auto layout support is fantastic, certainly by comparison in Xcode 5. So I think it's a really good upgrade.
I've also had very good luck with all the built-in provisioning and certificate and identity stuff that, in, you know, they've had the beginnings of this stuff in previous versions of Xcode, but it almost never worked right for me. And so it was one of those things like, oh yeah, sure, it's better this time. Sure, right. You know, maybe someday I'll try it and then it would fail. This time I've tried it and it actually works. And it works not 100% of the time, but a lot closer than it ever has before, where it'll automatically do a lot of the provisioning setup, the device setup, the certificates, the identity management. It's a lot easier and better if you have multiple developer identities, which is going to be huge for contractors. It's a lot easier for that. It actually handles it well instead of poorly or not at all like it did before. So overall, it's significantly improved in those areas.
Sean, any thoughts on Xcode?
Well, pretty much agree with the other guys. It's better.
Brent?
I like that the toolbar is a little less tall. I'm on a 27-inch iMac, but I still like every pixel is valuable when you're using Xcode.
Sort of the last thing I want to ask you guys about is there wasn't really much said about the App Store. It did get a few things like a kids section, and it did get local apps. And I live next to a train station, so every local app for me is a transportation app. But there was nothing in terms of demos or trials or upgrades or anything of the litany of other things that, you know, a variety of people have asked for. Marco, you've written a lot about this. Is that an indication that this is just the status quo, and as a developer, you're going to have to do the jury? What did he call it?
Basically, deal
animal
with
husbandry. Yeah,
right. You know, Apple always has long periods where they neglect something, and then they'll come out and surprise you with some major improvement all of a sudden out of the blue. So this could be one of those things. This could be, you know, oh, maybe, you know, next year WWDC they will finally give us these things that we want as developers: trials, paid upgrades, stuff like that. And the reality is, there's also this entire section of, or this entire category of things like that that Apple just doesn't really feel is necessary, or they don't care about, or they don't have time to care about, or there's other costs to it that we aren't considering. Like, everything that happens in the App Store, every policy, everything that's technically possible, you have to not only think about it as what we would like and how we would use it, you have to think about it as how Candy Crush would use it, and how all the scammers would use it, and how, like, hundreds of thousands of bad developers will use it in addition to the good ones. And so maybe they decided that the potential for abuse is too high, or the potential for angering customers is too high for some of these things. Who knows? So, you know, there's all those issues. I think you can only assume from the outside that if Apple has been totally silent on something for years and years and years, it's way safer to assume that they don't and never will care about it, rather than to assume that it's just right around the corner from a big upgrade out of the blue. So if they ever do give us paid upgrades and trials, stuff like that, great. You know, we'll deal with it then. But until then, I think the safest course of action is to assume they will never come and build your business around that assumption. And so for right now, the fact is, there's different numbers come out all the time, but I believe it's safe to say, based on all the numbers that we've seen, that over 90% and possibly well over 90% of downloaded apps are free. And that number has only gone up over time. So I think it's very obvious that the method, the business method that makes sense right now is free with an app purchase for something. And that's, of course, a very large, broad category. And you could do that a lot of different ways. But I think free with an app purchase is by far the clear winner over paid upfront right now. And the trend is only going further and further and further into that direction.
Brent, any changes for you business-wise with iOS 7?
No. No, we're still charging for our app and have no plans to go free in in-app purchase or anything. I think Marco's point is largely true, but you know, it's a giant app store with a lot of apps, and I think there is still room for some apps to go the old-fashioned route and still do very well. So we're sticking with our plan. Yep.
Yeah, I got small caps for free with your update.
Yeah, you did. You sure did. Free small caps. We could have charged you per letter, but we didn't.
I mean, that's the problem too. Like, you have an app like Vesper, and it's kind of hard to figure out what the in-app purchase would be there. You know, there's a whole Well, yeah, that's true. But yeah, like, there's this whole category of apps, a very large category of apps where it's not immediately obvious. Like, if they went to that free with in-app purchase model, like, what would that be that wouldn't suck?
Yeah, you know?
Right. And it's not an easy question.
Sean, I mean, in the history of Twitterific, it was there day one on every store ever, a $10 app when the app store began, and you've done with ads, you've done in-app purchase to get rid of ads, you've done pretty much anything that you can do. Are you looking at iOS 7 any differently than you have any past version?
We kind of are. We're still discussing that internally, actually. We're thinking about changing the model, but it's not definitive. And it's hard to say. I don't know. It's weird for us because we have the additional constraint of Twitter token limits. And so we can't mess around with like a parallel app, you know, because we would have a different token limit and it would run out. And we have lots of existing customers to think about too. I don't know. It's a tough business with utilities because utilities have a like continuous life cycle. You know, like you use them every day forever in some cases, things like Twitter apps, but you don't get money out of people every day forever. And yeah, it's tough to do that because, you know, monetization on like a Candy Crush is obvious. You know, you treat the in-app purchases like quarters in an arcade machine, but you know, do you really want to be putting quarters in your calculator? You know, I don't know. I don't know if there's an answer yet.
The less tokens you have left, the more you charge in-app to get an account on Twitterific.
Yeah. Well, we've considered that to some degree. I mean, there's a finite resource there.
Yeah, because for you, the incremental cost per user is not nearly zero. It's actually right, like it goes up with every user.
Yeah. And, you know, like we're thinking about trying that free with in-app purchase model again. But yeah, the token problem is a serious problem because, you know, if we got thousands and thousands of free users, those tokens are just gone. So how do you get them back? You know, you can't.
Well, and also like if the decision is like just you have an app that is in all respects, you know, a paid app, like it has all the features enabled, but you just have an ad somewhere in the app and then you pay money to hide the ad. That kind of business model does not bring in a lot of money because most people don't care about the ad. And it's not enough of a pain point. Like when you have, you know, shareware people have tried this for years. When you have, you know, some kind of free, here's the app for free, and then you can pay us money to do something, to upgrade to new features or to remove a limit or something like that. That pain point has to be very, very carefully adjusted so that people aren't hitting it immediately and becoming frustrated and just deleting your app and being angry at you, but that they hit it hard enough and soon enough into using the app that they really want to get past that limit. And it's a very, very hard thing to find, but once you optimize it, it's like it's radically different from when you have not found that optimization. So like if it just the app works just fine and here's an ad, or you pay a couple dollars to remove it, that is almost definitely not going to bring in a whole lot of money.
No, and I think that's especially tough for utilities. Like at least with a game, you can become sort of emotionally invested in that game's story or something right. like that. With a utility, it's like you hit that wall and you're like, well, I'm just going to go download the other free one or whatever, you know, that does the same thing.
Right. And that's the problem too. Like back, I mean, we even discussed this back a long time ago when I was at Tumblr. Vimeo had just launched Vimeo Plus, their paid plan. And we were talking at Tumblr before we decided, you know, how we're going to do long-term business stuff. We were talking about, you know, maybe we should do paid premium features because that was the cool thing to do at that moment. And we eventually decided not to because we realized, you know, Tumblr had gotten big in part by taking a couple of things that WordPress was charging money for and just giving them away for free with the idea, oh, we'll make money some other way later. And so if you decide, all right, I'm going to allow all these features except these three, and those three we're going to charge people money for, there's nothing stopping anybody else from releasing a very similar kind of app and giving away those three features for free and charging for some different three or figuring out their money plan later. And so whenever you're put in that position of charging for a couple of features, you leave yourself open to a lot of undercutting by anybody else. And so it's not always an easy thing to do.
So, well, and then along comes the VC-backed company who
yes.
will just give everything away for free forever. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Which Tumblr was.
Something we've talked about that I've not seen in the App Store is a subscription model. Now, I know you mentioned just a little while ago that you don't want to go there with the recurring subscription model, but I mean, is that the way it's got to go? I mean, at some point, there's a reality that, you know, it will never get paid upgrades and, you know, trying to convert people to your new version of your app where it's paid, you always lose people. Like every time you do that, I swear, it seems like it's half and half and half, you know, I mean, it's not really, but it's, you know, there's only a certain percentage that's going to convert and you're just going to hope that new customers make up the difference. You know, is paid subscription what Apple wants us to do?
Well, you have the exact same problem of losing subscribers. You know, like there's always the you know the rate of people who cancel their subscription too. Like there is no you know silver bullet to this. There's if you try paid upgrades, then some people are going to complain that you know that it's that you're doing it too often or not often enough, and your income is going to be really weird and spiky. If you do subscriptions, then people are going to complain that you don't have the incentive to keep the app updated and current because you're making money anyway. And a lot of people really object just fundamentally to subscription pricing of anything. You'll anger them. And then there's all the, you know, all the fall off. So there really is no good universal option. I think it's one of those things where, you know, we just have to experiment and see what happens.
Matt, any thoughts on the App Store before we close?
No, I have to defer to my brothers in arms here. I'm mainly a contractor, so I really don't have a lot of experience with the Wild West aspect of all this.
All right, so I'm just going to go around the room to finish this off and ask you all what you think of iOS 7 in general and what you'd like or what you hope that Apple addresses in the really near term if you have any pain points. I'll start with you, Matt.
You know, as a user, I'd like to see some more polish. I think that, you know, a lot of the patterns involved in the UI are really excellent and, you know, add to the intuition that have always been there. But, you know, visually, aesthetically, I think there's some work that could be done and I anticipate it will. From a technical perspective, I'd like to see some more things like the transparency. You know, I'd like to see the parallax and motion stuff get a little more... a little more easy to adopt. You know, I'm still really absorbing it all. And I think it's as deep an upgrade as we've had, since the original SDK.
Marco?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with all that Matt said. I would also agree that, yeah, it is like when we saw all the visual stuff they were changing during the keynote, I was like, wow, they've been really busy. Look at all the stuff they've done. And then when we saw all the API changes and then learning later that they also made everything 64-bit, they really have done a lot in the last year. So yeah, technically I'm actually very happy with it. Design-wise, I think there's going to be a lot of stuff that we need to shake out over time and learn how to use right, including Apple learning how to use it right. And from a user perspective, I think the biggest flaw right now is a pretty big lack of polish in the iPad version. The iPad version is pretty rough in a few areas. I think especially popovers and action sheets look awful. And it was very clearly a design made for the phone first. and then just kind of shove it onto the iPad. And I think maybe it could use some rethinking there.
Brent?
In a way, it reminds me of the original Aqua OS X, you know, which went really far in a lot of ways and needed to be dialed back over time. And I think some of that is true with iOS 7 too. There's in some places too much animation, taking too long to do animations, you know, too much stuff happening. And you don't have to get motion sickness necessarily just to kind of get a little tired of it, you know. But I think with the first release, they have to hit that nail on the head pretty hard to get everyone to notice, I suppose, and then dial it back later. But I hope they start dialing it back not too much later. And in the near term, I just want my UI text view bugs fixed.
Sean?
I think iOS 7 is, it shows a lot of promise, right? But it hasn't quite delivered it yet. I think it's got like this clear, opinionated design of the future that was trimmed down too far. I mean, it's kind of like what you guys are saying. You know, it lost a little too much whimsy for my taste. I mean, iOS 6 was a little crazy, but with the physicality, or not physicality, I guess, but the skeuomorphism stuff. And it's not that I miss that per se, but it's like it feels so modern and soulless in places, you know, like the multi-pane glass idea is great, except glass is kind of boring. So yeah, I'm hoping that they build on that a bit somehow, bring it back up a little. I mean, we kind of like the flat stuff, obviously, but you know, even now, like with Twitterific, we're experimenting a little bit with adding a little more color, you know, like coloring the whole tweet cells again and things like that. And iOS itself is lacking a lot of that. It just feels really plain in a lot of places. But technically, yes. I mean, it's great. They have to fix bugs now.
Yeah.
So, Sean, if people are interested in finding out more about you and more about Twitterific, where can they go?
Twitterific, iconfactory.com. Me personally, at BigZayFod on Twitter. That's about it.
Brent?
I have a blog at inessential.com, and I'm on Twitter as Brent Simmons.
I'd like to point out this is the second time you've been on Debug without cursing.
Fuck.
Marco?
Yeah, just marco.org or on Twitter, Marco Arment.
And Matt?
I'm on the web at appleoutsider.com, and I'm Drance on Twitter.
And this ended up being the Garfield without Garfield version of Debug because we did not get Guy on the show. But in the meantime, you can find him at kickingbear.com. He makes an app called Napkin in the Mac App Store, and he is GTE on Twitter. I'm at Rene Ritchie. You can find me at imore.com. And guys, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tell Guy that we didn't need him.
Thank you.
I'm not even telling him we did a show. It's going to just show up in his feed.
Awesome. Thanks, Rene.